Hello and welcome to the programme. Today, captured for the first time ever, the song of one of the rarest whales on the planet, the North Pacific right whale. Standing on the shoulders of giants, Terry Flanagan learns about picky eaters in the fish world and the threat global warming poses to the wildlife in our back gardens.
There's some very good evidence that the great tits, which is a common bird here in Ireland, across Europe, a garden bird, woodland bird, they rely on caterpillars to feed their chicks, largely on caterpillars, and caterpillars are very sensitive in their development to temperature. So as the temperatures have increased, the sort of annual peak in all of this caterpillar abundance has essentially shifted to earlier in the year by a couple of weeks. And the birds have in turn have responded by breeding earlier, but not early enough. So you get this timing mismatch between the birds and the food that they're feeding their chicks.
You can visit the website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney, for more on any item covered in today's programme and our extensive archive. Now, there's exciting research being carried out in Ireland into bats, and it's believed that it could enable us to tackle the ageing process and help us to live longer lives. We've discussed this on the programme before. The huge diversity of mammals has fascinated evolutionary biologists for centuries. From the largest 170-ton blue whale to the smallest 2-gram flying, echolocating bumblebee bat. Exploration of this vast diversity is now possible due to the development of state-of-the-art next-generation sequencing technologies and has led to some of the greatest insights into the functioning and evolution of the human genome. Professor Emmett Teeling, head of zoology in Trinity College Dublin, is an international leader in this field. She's developed a unique world-leading research programme which is using state-of-the-art technology with traditional field studies to uncover how to live healthier and longer.
First of all, I would like to say thank you very much to the Royal Irish Academy for giving me this opportunity to give a discourse. And also I'd like to thank the audience for coming out on a wet, rainy Tuesday evening. I was worried.
Our own Dr. Richard Collins joined Professor Teeling at a recent event in the Royal Irish Academy, where she shared her findings.
So my talk was about trying to understand and uncover what are the molecular mechanisms that bats have evolved that allow them resist aging, showing that bats repair their DNA as they age. They remove the cellular damage they experience from their high metabolic rate as they age, and that then we need to think about how can we then translate that into potentially making a drug for humans. Plus, we're going to understand aging. It's one of the most complex of all of the biologies. And by studying bats, studying naked mole rats, studying killifish, studying birds, studying humans in an aging context, we can understand one of the most complex biological phenomena.
When a baby is born in the maternity hospital, is there a little tag on its toe which says something like, best before the 18th of October 2029? And the nurses cut this off and they throw it away. Is this the case? Because from a geneticist's point of view, are we pre-programmed? Is there a kind of pre-programmed longevity, say 800 million heartbeats and so many breaths and so on and so on? Or is this model wrong?
Which is a very interesting question. The question is your lifespan predetermined on the day that you're actually born? And so there used to be a rational thought that potentially there was this clock and that the length of your lifespan was going to be predicted. Now, there are definitely things that would indicate whether or not you're going to have a longer lifespan. Typically, it's whether or not your grandparents and your parents had longer lifespans. So there is heritable factors that will correlate, such as heart disease can run in the family, potentially Alzheimer's can run in the family. Okay. So the question is whether or not longer lifespan is heritable. Mm-hmm. And there's certain people think, yes, it is. There are other people think maybe it's not quite, and that environment can play a huge role. But think about two identical twins. And you get identical twins, and you've got one that had, you know, did the right things, didn't smoke, didn't take all the wrong kinds of food and maybe live a slovenly life, it was more fit and more healthy, are they going to have a longer lifespan? Potentially, yes. Unless they both have some congenital disease that's going to kill them. What's very interesting at the moment, you've touched on this, is that is there any way that maybe there is a clock-like prediction of how one is going to age? And rather than just being looking at, say, example, telomeres that shorten with age or heartbeats, what they've now found is this thing called this methylation signature. And so what will happen is that as you age, you get these little methyl signatures on your genome that switch on and off different genes. And what they've shown in mice is that when you go sequence the genome and they look at these methylation sites, you can predict to the very day that lab mouse is going to die. They've now also shown that potentially in humans, you can look at the methylation signature in your on your genome and you can predict or you can guess how old somebody is. So potentially there is a clock, and the clock governs all vertebrates, and they're working on it at the moment. They've also shown that they can do these potential aging intervention methods and can slow that methylation down, or maybe you can rejuvenate that aging process down. But what this methylation signature maybe does is that it controls the genes and the expression of genes. And we know as we age, our genes become dysregulated. So potentially there is. But I think environment plays a huge role, which is genetics, plays a role with what you're exposed to and how you interact does. Definitely, long-lived grandparents predict that their offspring will be longer lived. The longest lived woman in the world, Jeanne Calment, she lived till she was 122, both as a grandparents lived and parents lived for a very long time.
Well, Emma, 10 million cells have come into the world. And they're a kind of envelope which will carry genes on to the next generation. Now, it's conceivable, a philosopher might say, well, it's just a vehicle for the transfer of genes onwards. And it makes sense, in a way, for it to have a finite life, because if it lingers on after it's transferred the genes after reproduction, then it's wasting up resources that would be better used by its offspring and grand offspring. So is there any truth in that way of looking at things?
Now, Richard, if you were to look at those things, that you would mean that women who are post-menopause should all be killed.
They shouldn't, because the woman is a filing cabinet. In our biology, vast information was stored. It's experience that can guarantee survival, and the woman will retain that experience for decades, and she will get her offspring and grand offspring out of a fix in years to come. So genetically, it is wise to keep this resource alive.
I completely agree. And menopause, not many mammals experience menopause. I know there's known documentation for us, potentially for whales also. And the idea of having a grandmother that can help the mother raise the offspring who can remember things, remember where to go. I think there's a correlation between survival, these are in primate societies, between survival of offspring and having a postmenopausal grandmother around. You've got much better chance if granny's around.
As we go through life, this collection of 10 million genes or cells is going to divide and break down and so on and reproduce. Now, there are these things called telomeres, which you mentioned all the time, little strings at the ends of cells. And every time a cell divides and produces daughter cells, it sheds some of these. And they gradually get worn down. I don't know how many there are, 50 or something like that in a cell. And when they're all used up, it is requiescant in pace, is it?
Yes. So the idea is that as your telomeres shorten and shorten and shorten and shorten, because your cell has replicated, it gets so short that this cell becomes a senescent cell. Now, what the cell should do is should self-destruct. And this is supposed to have been evolved as an anti-cancer mechanism. You don't want too many replications happening within the cell. Potentially, there's potential DNA damage there. So this healthy, this is what should happen. But something goes wrong sometimes, and that this senescent cell, this old cell, sits there. And the self-destruct doesn't happen. And it starts to emit this thing called SASP. And it's this signal to need pull other cells towards it to turn them into zombie cells. And all of a sudden you get this buildup of these old cells that aren't replicating, that are emitting all this SASP, causing other cells to get old, getting the immune system to be completely inflamed. This is supposed to be aging. And indeed, some of these companies now in Silicon Valley, they have invested lots of money into trying to remove these cells. Because they think if you can remove the old cells, you have a much higher chance of not driving the aging process faster. Indeed, people who were born with defects in their genes that allow them to maintain their telomeres age much more quickly. And this is potentially as a result of the problems of having too much of these senescent cells.
Now, you like to compare eat, drink and make merry animals, such as rats and things like that, and rabbits and things that live it up, live dangerously and die young, with safe, dull, rather careful kind of creatures. So we have on the one end of the spectrum with things like the Greenland shark, which clocks up 400 years, doesn't breed and he's 160 or something like that, and bowhead whales and things like that. And at the other end of the spectrum, you have things that last a couple of weeks. You know. Well, now, does the aging process in the bowhead whale go much more slowly? Do his cells live longer, survive longer than those of a shrew or something like that?
It's a really good question. And the question is, how fast can those cells turn over? The answer is, I actually don't know. So I'm not quite sure of that research. What I do know is that these whales have also evolved ways to slow down potentially the proliferation of their cells and potentially the fact that maybe their cells can become cancerous. This is required to be a very big-bodied animal, potentially telomeres. Rodents, on the other hand, they don't really care because they can wreak complete havoc. You have some other weird marsupials that also live way shorter than we expected, because what seems to happen is the males end up looking for mates, getting very aggressive, fighting, mating, and then dying. And the idea is that even if you take those animals into the lab, because we used to argue that with some of these marsupials, this living life to the high, fighting, mating, not eating, then death, that it was only because they were fighting too much or they were mating too much. But actually, there does seem to be a pre-programmed death within them, which maybe comes from too much hormones. So what I think is wonderful to think of all these different life history strategies that you see in different species. These rodents and rabbits make lots of babies very fast and then die. Bowhead whales, on the other hand, are the extreme. Live very slow, have fewer babies. The question is, which one is more evolutionary successful?
Now, the question I have for you is this. We are, of course, part of the great whale fraternity, the old, safe, ponderous, kind of long-lived, insurance-ridden kind of animals, do you see? And now we want to survive longer. So are we, we look at things like rats and things to find a way of doing this. Is this wise, and will it be a good thing if will we succeed? Will we find ways of living longer? And is that necessarily the right way to go?
Well, I think we will. I think we have to. But right now, let's think where we are. Globally, people everywhere are living longer. By 2050, there's going to be a 380% increase in people over the age of 80. We're all getting older. But our probability of having disease of the old age, cancer, Alzheimer's, dementia, stay the same. That's when we're 60 years of age. So we have to find a solution. There's right now in the United States, people are trying drugs such as metformin. I think it's the eighth most prescribed drug in America. It was originally a drug for diabetes, but they found there was all these beneficial effects in terms of the aging process. They yet don't know exactly what it is that it does. It seems to a lot of the things that I see that in the bats, they seem to have modulated to allow them to slow down the aging process. They also know what dosage should take to really have this life extension effect. One of the reasons why we don't is because people were quite opposed to clinical trials. They weren't going to allow it. They were going to let us do it. And I think this is because we were in this, as Aubrey de Grey calls it, we're in this pro-aging trance. We've got to stop that. These are diseases that are caused by living. So living, your metabolism causes damage. And when that damage then becomes pathogenic, that's disease. That's old age. But imagine if you could stop it. So wouldn't it be much better to have a society that could function until their death? Because you can't stop aging entirely, but you can slow down the ill effects of aging. And that's all I'm trying to argue, is shorten the morbidity, have your lifespan, your health span at the same. And maybe there are things that you can do. Exercise, starve. Even the jury's out in really how good starving is. Take potentially some of these drugs. Have a stress-free life. Find ways. And I think people everywhere, we're living healthier, but we need to make sure that we can live healthier longer. And I still think that studying these bats, studying the naked mole rats, studying these extraordinary aging extremists will give us insights in what we need to do. And when do we need to start this intervention?
At birth or late middle age.
Or post-puberty.
Post-puberty. Because that's when we need to start.
Yeah, maybe that's when we need to start.
Emma, you are an inspiration. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Richard.
Thank you, Richard. And for more on bats, visit the website rte.ie/Mooney. Now, you might remember a couple of weeks ago, Dr. Simon Barrow, who's Chief Scientific Officer and CEO with the Irish Whale and Dolphin Group, was on talking about the fin whale that turned up in the River Liffey and then was buried in Dollyman Strand. And he was talking about sound recordings and how they go about making sound recordings of whales in the open ocean and what that means to them and what they can learn from this. Anyway, why am I telling you all this? Well, for the first time, marine biologists have recorded singing by one of the rarest whales on the planet, the North Pacific right whale. Researchers at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, used moored acoustic recorders to capture repeated patterns of calls made by male North Pacific right whales. North Pacific right whales are the rarest of all large whale species and among the rarest of all marine mammal species. And this is the first time the right whale songs in any population have been documented. Jessica Krantz is fisheries marine biologist with the US Scientific Agency, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and she told me all about it.
The North Pacific right whale was named the right whale because it was the right whale to kill. It can grow to be up to about 60 feet long. So it was slow, very fatty and oily, and it floated when it was killed. So it became the target of extensive whaling in the 1800s. And it's estimated that between 26 and 37,000 animals were taken in just a few decades. And then in the 1960s, the Soviets began hunting them illegally and just decimated what was left of the population and brought them down to their current numbers, which our best estimate at this point is only around 30 individuals. So they are extremely rare and extremely endangered.
Now, in which oceans can we find these mammals?
The only place we know for sure that they exist is the southeastern Bering Sea in the summer. Historically, they were distributed widely throughout the entire Bering Sea and North Pacific, but now their range is quite constricted. And the only place we know for sure that you can find them is in the southeastern Bering Sea in the summer months. We still don't know where they go, when or if they leave the Bering Sea. We don't know what their migration routes are, where their breeding or calving grounds are. So there is still a lot about this population that we don't know.
You've got recordings of these whales' vocalizations. How rare are these recordings and what's special about them?
Every year we do detect right whale calls. So we do know that every year they go to that location to where our recorders are. But recording them from a year-round recorder and actually seeing them are two very different scenarios. We will often go years without seeing a single animal. So every year when we're out at sea, we are constantly monitoring in real time for right whales. And although we may hear them on occasion, we went 5 years once without seeing a single right whale. Within those 5 years, we were out at sea and we were monitoring, but we didn't have the time to specifically go and look for them. But there were a couple years where we did have a dedicated survey and just did not find any. You know, we might hear them acoustically, but actually going and finding the animal is very rare. They're the proverbial needle in a haystack.
And these sounds qualify as song?
We know that right whales make a variety of calls or sound types, but we haven't ever discovered those sound types being produced in any manner that resembles song or patterns. And in 2010, when we were out at sea, we started detecting this pattern of gunshot sounds. And the gunshot is one of the predominant call types for our population. And so we tried to locate the calling animal, but never found it. We were in thick fog and rough seas. So at the time, we kind of dismissed it as maybe an anomaly. But then we started going back into our long-term recorder data and going through several years' worth of data, and we found that same pattern occurring again, as well as three other kinds. So now we're starting to think, okay, well, this really looks like patterns. We think this is a right whale, but we never got visual confirmation until 2017 when we were out at sea again and we're finally able to get that visual confirmation and say, yes, this is a right whale, and yes, it is singing.
Now, these blunt noises you describe as gunshot-type sounds, they're not at all harmonious, so how do they qualify as song?
These songs sound very different from what people would think when we say whale song. They tend to think of, you know, humpback whales that have very melodious sounds and very almost haunting, beautiful calls. And our songs are comprised almost entirely of this impulsive, almost percussive sounding call. It's called the gunshot. So, you know, when you listen to it, it doesn't immediately strike you as being song. But what classifies it as a song is the fact that it is extremely regular. The timing in between the gunshots is very precise. The number of gunshots and the timing in between them, the rhythmic patterning of it, and the fact that that pattern is repeated over and over for hours is what classifies it as song. So males tend to produce the gunshot sound much more frequently than females do. And it's been hypothesized before that the gunshot may be used in some kind of a reproductive display. So the fact that these songs are comprised mainly of gunshots leads us to suspect that this is a reproductive display and that it is maybe a way of attracting mates.
Just looking at the technical side of things, Jessica, how did you go about recording them?
We first recorded it using an instrument called a sonobuoy, and that is a free-floating instrument that allows us to listen in real time to sounds as they are being produced. So it transmits audio signals back to a receiver on a vessel in real time. So whenever we are out at sea, we are monitoring in real time and can hear a call as the whale makes it. And these instruments also have directional capabilities. So not only can we say we're hearing the sound, but it's coming from this direction over here. So then you can deploy two or more and actually triangulate or localize on that calling animal. It depends on the oceanographic features at the time, obviously the how loud the whale is making the sound, but we have detected these as far away as about 40 nautical miles.
40 nautical miles doesn't sound like much when compared with the distances other whale species communicate over.
Well, it's a decent distance, but you know, you have to consider the environment. When you hear that blues and fin whales can, you know, their calls can travel for hundreds or plus kilometers or miles, that's often in deep water where they kind of hit what we call the SOFAR channel. It's the ideal conditions for sound propagation, and so that's what allows their calls to travel so far. But the Bering Sea, where the right whales are, is very shallow. It's usually less than 100 meters. And so you don't get the propagation in the Bering Sea that you would in one of the deeper water channels. So it's very possible that these calls propagate farther than we're detecting them. I'm sure whale hearing is, you know, much more sensitive than what we can detect. But yeah, a lot of it is just the nature of the shallow Bering Sea shelf.
You mentioned earlier that you believe there are as few as 30 North Pacific right whales remaining in the world.
Our current population estimate is only at around 30 individuals. And within that, it's a roughly 2-to-1 male-biased sex ratio, or potentially even as high as 3-to-1, which unfortunately is the opposite ratio you want when you're trying to rebuild and recover a population. So it's really kind of a dire situation for these animals.
So given that there are so few, what's the future for the North Pacific right whale?
You know, that's a good question and one that we hope to be able to answer. I think a lot of us are still hoping that there is some cache of right whales in the North Pacific that we haven't yet discovered. But extinction is a very real threat for this population. You know, the loss of even a single animal would be detrimental, especially when you consider that, to the best of our knowledge, we only have around 8 or 9 females left in the population. So they very much have a long road ahead of them. It's a very dire situation. But, you know, we owe it to them to give them every effort and to give it our best shot. So we remain hopeful that they can recover, provided they manage to avoid a lot of the threats that face them. You know, there is still a chance. So the eternal optimist in me wants to say, yes, that they have a shot.
In terms of your research, are aspects of the whale song still under analysis? And what are you hoping to find?
So this discovery of song in our population, it almost raises more questions than it answers. We really want to be able to find out, first of all, is this truly unique to our population, or has it just not yet been discovered in the other populations? If it is unique to our population, why is that? Why is it that the rarest and most endangered of the right whale populations is the one that is singing? And perhaps most importantly, what is the function of this song? Based on what we know about song in other whale species, our best guess and our current hypothesis is that this is some kind of a reproductive display, similar to song in humpback whales or bowhead whales. But with such a small sample size and with sightings being so infrequent, you know, it may be a long time before we can answer that. So one of the things that we really hope will come from this discovery of song is, you know, I mentioned that we still don't know where the migration routes or breeding grounds are for this population. But if there are detections of this song outside of the Bering Sea, then that is a really clear indicator of right whale presence. So our colleagues who have recorders in locations all around the Pacific, if they detect these songs and these patterns, that's a really clear indicator that there's a right whale in that area. So perhaps, you know, getting additional detections will help us to start to answer those questions of where are these animals going when or if they leave the Bering Sea.
Thanks, Jessica. Now, we continue our mini-series on the shoulders of giants, in which Mooney Goes Wild reporter and biologist Terry Flanagan highlights some of the many research projects being carried out here in Ireland, where academics use the understanding gained by major thinkers from the past to learn more about the natural world and build up our body of knowledge into the future. Today we visit the zoology department in Trinity College Dublin. Sam Preston has just begun his PhD studies on dietary conservatism, something that you and I might describe as picky eating, a phenomenon we probably thought only occurred in difficult children. Not so, says Sam, because over the last number of years, it has been shown that dietary conservatism occurs in many species of mammals, birds, fish, and even in some insects. Sam wants to know more about how organisms learn to decide on what to eat, and more importantly, what not to eat.
I'm working on the three-spined stickleback, a native Irish species.
Which we used to call pinkeens many, many years
back
ago.
Back in the day, because of the red belly of the males when they're mating.
That's it. And what are you doing with them?
I'm looking at their diet. I'm looking at dietary behaviour. Specifically, I'm looking at dietary conservatism. Imagine you've got picky eaters and non-picky eaters.
Right.
So you're picky.
Like as in children.
Exactly like with children. So imagine you give a new food to a fish and it takes it immediately. It's very happy to eat this new food. It's not very picky. But some fish are very picky and you give them a new food and they won't eat it.
Right.
And they won't eat it for a very long time. And it's not just fish. It's fish, birds. In fact, it's every animal that's been tested for this behavior of refusing new foods has found that some of them are picky and they won't eat it.
I suppose the classic example would be rats. And I'm thinking particularly of rat poison.
Absolutely. People think of avoiding the new thing. They think of rats because rats are a classic model for neophobia. Neophobia and dietary conservatism.
Right. Well, what's neophobia then?
Neophobia is this fear of the new.
Right.
Fear
okay.
of the novel. So you put out poison for a rat and the rat sees this in its environment and it's new. So the rat goes, I'm not going anywhere near that. But now imagine that that rat doesn't just avoid the novel poison, but it avoids novel foods for a very long time, even after it stopped really being new. And it's not really afraid of it. It's just not eating it.
And you're doing this study on these fish. Why fish?
Fish are a really suitable organism to work with. They're a great model organism because you can keep lots of them in a lab. They are known to have this dietary conservatism behavior. They're very well known in their behavioral biology, so there's a lot of existing literature and knowledge out there to work with. There's a wealth of knowledge of how to keep and breed them. We have their DNA sequence, we have their genome sequence. They've been used as a behavioral model for lots of different things. It's just fantastic to have kind of a background to be able to build on rather than working with a new fish from the start and knowing nothing about it or why it was doing certain things.
And really what you're trying to do is you're trying to teach them not to be conservative.
I'm trying to find out if there are ways that they learn to not be conservative.
Because that would be an advantage to them.
It absolutely would be. But it also works in the reverse. Imagine you have a situation where you want to protect your crops and you've got a pest, like starlings, for instance. If we could harness the DC individuals that don't like new crops, suddenly you plant something new there, or maybe you've just coloured the food somehow with a harmless dye, then maybe the DC individuals could lead all the other individuals away in search of food that they're familiar with. Mm-hmm. So it actually works in both directions.
You must have had an interest in fish before now, because it's not something that most people really have an interest in. Tell us the background.
Well, why wouldn't you have an interest in fish? I grew up on David Attenborough Trials of Life, and I was lucky enough to grow up by the seashore as well.
Right.
So rock pooling was something I did all the time. I didn't go fishing, but I'd go lifting up every big rock looking for eels, gobies, blennies, crabs, anything at all. And I thought I was going to be a marine biologist when I was 4. And when I got to Trinity eventually, I studied zoology. I did some marine biology, but I discovered that I really liked evolution and behaviour, which is kind of like current evolution, what things are doing now, why they're doing it.
But in one sense, you're not really studying the fish, you're just using them as a model for your behaviour work.
Exactly. So while I am working with fish, which is kind of like my first passion, I'm actually using them to study a much broader concept, and that is how things decide what to eat, how things learn what to eat, and ultimately, I hope, how those decisions affect population survival and their ecology and how they function in the wild.
Now, you've only just started this project, but you have done some work on it for your master's.
Yeah, I did a very similar project for my master's, using fish as a model again and looking at groups. It was a very small study, but it showed that some groups of individuals did in fact behave very picky towards the novel food, even though they could be learning from one another. Fish see each other mouthing food all the time. They'll pick it up and spit it back out, and they fight over mouthed food as well. So one fish picks up and spits it out. The other one comes along and then eats it. Mm-hmm. So you would think that's a great opportunity for them to learn new foods are okay. But apparently they don't always do that, and I'm very curious as to why.
Now, a lot of people would think that fish are stupid. I mean, how many times have we been told that goldfish only have a memory of 4 seconds?
We've been told too many times, because it's not true. Goldfish actually have quite good memories. They can remember what time of the day they get fed, and they'll be expecting their food at that time of day, and you can see it if you watch them. My fish are very much the same. You can teach them after a few days of just getting the same colour food that this is their food, this is their familiar food, and they will prefer it over other foods that you give them. Okay. Until you teach them then that the new foods are also okay. So it takes some time for them to learn, but once they do, that knowledge stays.
And you have all your fish here in Trinity?
I do at the moment. There are some downstairs outside and some inside in the lab. Would you like to go and take a look at them?
Absolutely. Lead me to it. So this is your lab.
Yeah, this is the lab. This is the behavioural ecology lab. And
it's quite small, actually. I thought it had visions of it being bigger.
Well, the college likes to keep you in as small a space as possible. And I like it. It's a really cosy little lab. And
okay, and here's your fish, are they?
Everything. Here they are. So this guy here, he's not too shy. He's moving a little bit, waving his fins.
Okay, he's blue 013 in, yeah. Whatever that means.
That's okay. Just the notation I've given them in order to be able to term which fish is which from my notes.
Right, okay. And what you have then is you have one fish in each container here.
Yeah, so they start off in a group container, but when it comes to individual testing, they go into one single fish to a tank.
Right. Okay, and you feed them on Daphne, I'm told, and these are your Daphne.
So I've got some of the Daphne I've collected from Herbert Park, actually, in here. They're Daphne and Magna.
And you're hoping to breed these Daphne, is that right?
Yeah, I'm trying to get these guys to create a nice system. I'm basically trying to make a Daphne farm, actually.
Right, okay.
And I've got lots of little trial pots where I try different feeding regimens, different water. And I've even got different strains of Daphne from other researchers in the lab or in the department.
Right.
And
so what you have here is a large number of containers, maybe 10 or 15 containers. And daphnia in each of them with a different food source, is it, for the daphnia?
It's actually different food amounts for the daphnia. I started off with different food sources, but I discovered that feeding them on a mixture of yeast and algae worked really, really well. So they're now all getting yeast and algae, whereas previously it was one or the other.
So really what you're trying to do here is, first thing you're trying to do is you're trying to develop a method of breeding the daphnia, which is the food source for your fish.
Yes, it would be.
How are you going to colour the daphnia?
How do I colour the daphnia? Oh, it's very easy, actually. It's a food colouring. Exactly the same stuff you'd use in baking or making cakes or icing. And you just let the daphnia sit in this for about 15 minutes and they hold their colour beautifully for well over an hour.
Okay, so that's a blue, that one, and I see
I've got
a black
blue
there.
And I've got a black. Okay. We've used other colours in the past, but we're trying these ones at the moment.
So what you hope to do then is you hope to start feeding, training these fish to take different types of coloured daphnia. Is that right?
Yes. So the fish you saw in there have been familiarised, they've been trained to either take black or blue. So when you said blue 13, he's been familiarised with blue, that's his familiar colour.
Right.
And black is his novel colour. And then he's been going through testing to see how long it takes him to take the black as readily as he takes the blue. Basically, how long does it take to stop him being picky?
So you're going to train these particular fish to take particular foods. When they've gotten used to taking that particular colour, what are you going to do then?
Well, then they go into their actual testing. You give them an opportunity to eat their familiar food and also the novel food. And you try to work out... Sorry, this is really annoying to explain because it's an evolution test.
Right.
I know I'm getting a bit useless for you here. But basically, you give them a high proportion of familiar food and a low proportion of novel food. And then you see what they eat. You let them eat half of the food. And the next day, you give them the same amount of food, but the proportions are determined by whatever remains the previous day. So in this case, it's 19 familiar, 1 novel. And if they eat 10, let's say they eat 10 familiar, then it's only 9 familiar left and 1 novel left. It goes back up to 20, there'll be 18 familiar and 2 novel.
Okay, so it's quite technical.
There's a little bit of maths behind it.
Yeah, statistics.
It's hard to explain, but once you've actually done it a couple of times, it's very straightforward.
Now, how is that going to help you in understanding behaviouralism or evolution in fish?
It's going to help me understand whether or not this fish is picky or not, whether or not he's a dietary conservative fish. And if I can develop a robust method for testing quickly whether or not they're dietary conservative, it'll make it easier to make groups of fish where I know whether each fish is going to be picky or not when it comes to new food. And then I'm going to see how that group responds to new foods if you give them the opportunity to eat them. Do the picky fish learn from the not picky fish, or do the not picky fish copy the picky fish and decide not to eat the novel food at all? These fish are just from the wild, and when they're done here in the lab, we'll be bringing them right back to release in the wild. I've got funding for 3 years for my PhD.
Right.
If I could get a fourth year as well, that would be fantastic because it'll give me more time to test more things.
And who's funding it?
I'm getting funding from Trinity College, actually. I was lucky enough to receive the Usher Award, which covers my fees and a stipend, but it doesn't give me any operating budget. So I'm kind of working with whatever other researchers have been kind enough to give me.
Okay. That's James Usher, is that right?
Yes, that's the one.
The man of evolutionary fame who said that the Earth was created on the 23rd of October in the year 4004 BC at 12 noon or something like that. That's the man. Irish Archbishop.
It's a little bit ironic that I'm working on this, but I'm not going to argue on that at the moment. We could be here all day.
Don't forget, you can visit the website anytime you like, rte.ie/ Mooney. Now, sometimes when we think of the impact climate change is having on wildlife, we imagine distant and remote animals like snow leopards or polar bears. We think less about the effect global warming is having on the wildlife in our back garden. New research is making us think again, however. It shows that several species which are widespread across Ireland may not adapt fast enough to keep pace with climate change. The international team looked mostly at birds and found that many common species, including the magpie and great tit, could become extinct due to projected rapid warming. Dr. Thomas Reid is co-author of the study and senior lecturer in zoology at University College Cork. Thomas, tell us about this study and who was involved.
Sure, Derek. So this was a study that involved an international team of collaborators. So there were actually 64 of us from across Europe, Ireland and the UK. So I was the sole Irish person on the team. And basically what we did was we pulled together information from lots of different what we call long-term population studies of animals. And in the end, the data set, when we whittled it down, was predominantly birds, about 95% birds, because birds are, tend to be particularly well studied in this regard. So basically we pulled together this information from all these different long-term studies on how birds and a few other animals have been responding to climate change in recent decades. And then secondly, we sort of projected forward into the future to ask, given what we've observed in the past, what might be the likely outcomes for these populations in the future? So in a nutshell, what we found was when we looked at to the past, we sort of looked at two key types of processes or traits that are involved in responding to climate change. So one of these is the timing of key biological events, so what we call phenology. And a major finding prior to our study, you know, lots of studies have found that basically climate change is kind of advancing the timing of biological spring, especially in temperate parts of the world. So places like Ireland, Northern Europe, the leaves are coming on the trees earlier in spring and the insects are active and hatching out earlier and earlier. And so a lot of the animals are then are trying to sort of keep pace with those changes, those timing changes in their environment. And our first major result basically is we found indeed across these scores of species involved, we found that they are shifting their timing to get earlier. So they're laying their eggs earlier in the year or they're migrating earlier in the year. And that's a good thing. That's a good thing in that they're tracking these changes in their environment, the changes in sort of the timing of biological spring. However, the second thing that we looked at was, well, we asked, how does this translate into their reproductive success? So in a nutshell, what we found was that indeed, not only does the early bird catch the worm, but they also fledge more chicks on average. So we find that earlier breeding birds or earlier migrating birds tend to sort of do better, tend to have higher reproductive success. So that's the kind of good news in that they're sort of adaptively tracking changes in their environment. But then I suppose the more pessimistic outlook of the study was they don't seem to be tracking these changes perfectly. So the reason why we could say that the evidence there that they're not tracking this perfectly is that we can quantify what we actually call the strength of natural selection for these phenology traits. And without sort of going into the technical details, what we found was that the bird populations we looked at on average don't seem to be breeding quite early enough to be keeping track with these changes in their environments. And we can see signatures of that in their reproductive success. So this is a kind of a Darwinian natural selection process in action in the wild.
Thomas, you must be unique in this group because we are an island. Now, that has implications for things which want to change their way of life because of climate change. If you take the amphibians, the reptiles and the mammals, they can't go anywhere. They have to put up with what comes. But the birds are different. They can vote with their feet. And if they don't like it here, they can move to Scotland or to England or to the continent or wherever. So we are an unusual case. In mainland Europe, they can do all kinds of strange things. Now, if you look at the balance sheet, what's come and what has gone, the first sign of climate change here, a really big change, was 1969 when the white throat disappeared. Climate change had altered.
Now, you better explain what the white throat is, Richard.
Well, the white throat is a little warbler, a lovely little warbler that comes from Africa. It has to fly across the Sahara and the Sahel. Now, due to climate change, the Sahel was drying up. So the poor old little white throat had further to go and further to go, and it suffered as a result. So there was a huge crash in the white throat population. But since then, all kinds of interesting things have happened. You've had three species of egret moving north. The great white and the cattle are breeding in England, and the little egret is breeding here. You have hooper swans coming down and breeding here from Iceland. You have the great skua breeding here. All kinds of change seems to depend on climate change. Redneck phalaropes have gone, on the other hand. So there's a kind of swings and roundabouts kind of effect, Tom.
Absolutely, Richard. So one of the sort of big, I suppose, pictures to emerge from all of this is that climate change is kind of shaking up the status quo. So as you described there, we sort of have the numbers of different species wax and wane as the climate changes. And for a small little island like Ireland, you know, we can lose some species as the climate changes, but we can also gain others. So you mentioned a few cases there of the loss there of the white throat, but the gain of others. There's some very interesting work as well looking at our winterine water bird populations, so ducks, geese, swans, etc. You mentioned the whooper swan, Richard. There's another species, the Bewick swan, and their numbers have declined precipitously in Ireland since the sort of 1990s.
You make it sound as if that's a problem. It isn't. It's because the whooper doesn't have to come here anymore. He's doing so well elsewhere.
The Bewicks, yes. So that's it. So they breed up in Northern Europe, Arctic Russia. And as you say, they just might not have to come as far afield as Ireland anymore during the winter months to avoid sort of inclement conditions further north. So that's true. So in a way that could be deemed a good thing, but I suppose they're also getting hammered at the breeding grounds. And so climate change is hitting the Bewick swans up at the breeding grounds as well. You can look at a local level like Ireland and you can see how sort of the numbers of different species are waxing and waning and things are arriving and things are leaving. But we kind of need to think of the bigger global picture for some of these species that have broad ranges and are indeed migratory, so like the swans we talked about. And they're being hit by climate change both in their wintering areas, but also in their breeding grounds and in the stopover sites in between. And so, you know, some species are profiting from the warmer conditions, but others are certainly suffering.
These birds are migratory. They come here expecting certain conditions and the climate has changed and they don't arrive in time. I understand how that might be in effect. But you mentioned that the birds that are breeding here, things like magpies and great tits, that they're also in trouble and not changing, not starting early enough. But what is the problem? I mean, if the weather gets warmer and the magpie just sort of doesn't breed till next week, is he going to run out of food at the other end? I mean, you know, if you're rearing your chicks in May and June, surely there's still some food for them there. It's not as if they're breeding in September and October and the winter catches up on them or anything like that. So why would the fact that they don't start with the gun at the beginning of March or beginning of April when spring is coming earlier, why does that affect their breeding status? Surely there's enough food in this season for them anyway.
Yeah, so you make a couple of good points there. And I guess just to say, first of all, that this big study I talked about, none of the data actually came from Ireland. So, you know, I can't really talk about magpie populations in Ireland in that respect. But, you know, the magpie was one of the population studies. I think it came from Europe, mainland Europe. So in general, what we can say is that for a lot of these species, they can change when they breed or when they migrate. But, you know, the whole ecosystem is sort of changing in parallel, but not necessarily perfectly so. So what you can get is these asynchronies and mismatches emerge where there's, say, the magpie might be breeding a week or two earlier now than it used to, but the food that it relies upon maybe to feed its chicks might be sort of peaking even earlier in the season. And so they might be missing that peak. Now, we don't actually have good data on this for magpies. So if I could just shift to talk about great tits, which is a species that we have loads of good information on. There's some very good evidence that the great tits, which is a common bird here in Ireland, across Europe, a garden bird, woodland bird, they rely on caterpillars to feed their chicks, largely on caterpillars. And caterpillars are very sensitive in their development to temperature. So as the temperatures have increased, the sort of annual peak in all of this caterpillar abundance has essentially shifted to earlier in the year by a couple of weeks. And the birds have in turn have responded by breeding earlier, but not early enough. So you get this timing mismatch between the birds and the food that they're feeding their chicks. And like you say, there might still be enough food for some of them later in the season, but it's not enough potentially. And then they start to feel the impacts of that in terms of essentially the number of chicks that they can successfully raise or in the subsequent survival of those chicks.
Yeah,
so that's one of the key mechanisms here is what we call phenological mismatch that could, you know, lie at the heart of some of these problems.
Caterpillars change and burst their coats and get hairier and hairier and hairier. So the great tits want them when they're baldy little tiny green ones. They don't want big hairy God's horses, which were not good for. So if they've missed, if the caterpillars have moved on and the chicks aren't there in time, they're getting fed to big hairy caterpillars and that ain't good
for them.
Yeah, so that's really what's happening there. But things like magpies, you would imagine, are much more Catholic in their tastes and can eat lots of stuff. But then, as you say, it's not the Irish data for those. So it's they're not speeding up quickly enough.
As you say, species like magpies are, you know, much more generalist in their habits and they can eat a range of different items. So we're not sure what's going on exactly with the magpies. But there is some interesting work in the UK, actually, showing that generalist species, so species that tend to be able to live in a range of different habitats or eat a range of different things, they seem to be doing much better with climate change than more specialised species. So, for example, the UK, and this has happened in Ireland as well, you know, the numbers of specialist species like corn buntings or grey partridges that really rely on grassland, cereal type landscapes, those species have declined drastically in the UK, and indeed we've lost our breeding corn buntings here in Ireland. Whereas more generalist species like great spotted woodpecker have greatly increased in numbers and expanded their ranges, and even, you know, have now pushed into eastern parts of Ireland. So a key kind of finding there is that climate change is sort of homogenizing the bird communities, where things are kind of becoming more similar. You're losing a lot of the specialists and you're gaining more of the generalists.
Thomas, it seems to me that you have a hell of a problem on your hand, because it's never a single reason for death or decline. It's always multifactorial. You mentioned things like the corn bunting. Well, the corn bunting thrived in the old days when Ireland was a cereal-producing country, but it moved more to pasture, and then, of course, things like partridge and corn bunting declined, not so much because of the climate, but because of the habitat. The habitat is gone, new pressures. So, and this is happening right across the board. You're going to have all kinds of changes going on, so it's going to be very difficult to pin a change on any one bird. I think the magpie is particularly interesting, because the magpie doesn't migrate. Our Irish magpies, we used to think they came at Cromwell, but they didn't. They came in 1672, and they never go anywhere. So they're like the mammals. They're stuck on this island. So it would be very interesting to see how the Irish magpie fares, whereas in Europe, they will be connected with the magpies all the way across and up and down the continent. So it'd be harder to track what's going on.
I wonder, would anybody care if the magpie was on the decline? Anyway, go on, Thomas, yeah?
I for one, would.
Would you, really?
No, you're absolutely right, Richard, and I didn't mean to imply that corn buntings have declined necessarily because of climate change. I was using it rather as an example of a sort of a highly specialised species in the grander scheme of things. But, I mean, this is a key point, that attributing the loss or decline of a given species to one thing or the other, it's very difficult, because we can't do natural experiments. Everything's happening simultaneously. Indeed, probably habitat changes and loss are more the driver for species like corn buntings or grey partridges. But my point was more just that the general pattern is that with things like climate change, specialised species, they sort of have less tricks up their sleeve, if you like. They're less adaptable, whereas generalist species who can live in a range of different habitats or eat a range of different foods, they're more buffered against environmental change as a whole. And so it's sort of hard to make hard and fast conclusions here, but that's one conclusion that's emerging in the literature, is that generalists might profit while specialists suffer. If I could just actually give another interesting example that is more related to climate change there. A study in Finland recently has shown that so we have wader species like the lapwing and the curlew, mm-hmm. and they build their nests traditionally in those parts of Finland on barley fields. And basically they would nest after the farmers had sown their crops in the spring. But as temperatures have increased, the birds are now laying their eggs earlier, so they're nesting earlier, but before the farmers have got to the fields. And so now the farmers are coming in unwittingly because they can't see them, and they're destroying the nests with their tractors and machinery. So basically the researchers found that farmers in Finland, they are sowing their fields a week earlier now than they used to because of climate change. So over four decades, the farmers are sowing their barley sort of about a week earlier. But these birds, the lapwings and the curlews, are actually laying their eggs 2 to 3 weeks earlier. So you get this mismatch here between what the birds are doing and what the humans are doing. And that's kind of bad news for the poor old birds. So there are a number of these examples emerging where changes in seasonality are kind of upsetting the status quo, and it's leading to these mismatches between birds and animals and their environments, or indeed with humans.
Well, at least we're highlighting it for a start, and you can read that report, I'm sure. We can put a link to the report, Thomas, on our website, if that's okay with you. It's rte.ie/mini. Thomas, thank you very much indeed. That's all we have time for today. My thanks to all the guys who worked on the programme, Anna Leddy, to Jarlath, to Jamie on sound, our contributors Amy Lana and Richard Collins. Until next week, goodbye.